Why do we cook and eat the way we do? We will talk about how kitchen technologies over time have transformed what we do in the kitchen and what we eat at our kitchen tables as we consider the fork. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, November 15th. We'll talk about the past, the present, and the future of kitchen technologies and gadgets and how they affect society. We're going to talk with the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. And we will welcome your questions. Maybe we'll welcome your memories of kitchens past, gadgets you used to think you couldn't live without that are in a drawer somewhere maybe, or the kitchen utensils that you love today. What kitchen gadget or technology do you use the most? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll also welcome any questions or thoughts you have for our guest. She is a food writer, a historian, and author of a weekly column for the Sunday Telegraph's Stella magazine. B. Wilson has been named BBC Radio's Food Writer of the Year and a 3-time Guild of Food Writers Food Journalist of the Year. She has written other books, including Swindled, The Dark History of Food Fraud, and her newest book is Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. And she joins us from Cambridge, England. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
It's very nice to have you with us. So why should we consider the fork?
I think the utensils we use in the kitchen often get neglected in our food culture. We obsess so much about ingredients that sometimes we miss the bigger picture of the tools and techniques that actually get our food on the table. And if we think of how this universal business of feeding ourselves has changed dramatically over the centuries, I would argue the thing that has made the biggest difference has been the tools that we use.
Yeah, and how about the fork in particular?
Well, the fork in particular is something, I mean, it's now arguably the most universal eating utensil. It's used in every kind of meal other than handheld sandwiches or hamburgers. It would be used in a kind of casual fast food meal where it might be in a kind of plastic form. It'd be used in a fancy 3-course Michelin-starred restaurant where it might be silver-plated or certainly fancy stainless steel. But in historic terms, the fork is really recent. And when it was first introduced in Europe, almost everyone recoiled and thought, this is a strange and rather effeminate object, and people thought it was absurd. Why would you want to put some metal prongs into your mouth along with your food? And it was only in Italy for many centuries that people used forks, the reason being pasta, because the fork is a perfect implement, as we all know, for twirling long noodles or spaghetti. And the Italians started off using a 1-pronged instrument, and then they found that if 1 prong was good, 2 prongs were even better, and 3 were better still. But in the rest of Europe, where people were eating using their fingers and a knife, and they were eating meals more based on kind of bread and cheese or meat, they thought the fork was completely superfluous. So I think it's a great example of something that has just entered our culture so completely we don't give the fork a second thought most of the time.
Yeah,
and yet there's another way of doing things. We don't have to use forks.
No, I suppose we don't, but it is an example on how if we were eating meals before that could be easily eaten with our fingers or knives, the fork opened up a lot more food opportunities.
In some ways it opens up food opportunities, and in some ways it restricts us. I mean, if you look at the kind of craziness of some of the etiquette books of the 19th century, which are suggesting that, you know, the politest way to eat, once the fork was adopted, anything you could eat with a fork as a rule of thumb, you should. So then they're suggesting these elaborate ways of balancing peaches with a knife and fork, or attempting to eat corn on the cob with a knife and fork, which really just seems nonsense when you could just pick it up with fingers and eat it far more easily. I think the thing where forks did make a huge difference wasn't so much in helping us to eat better, but they actually changed our anatomy. And this was the thing that startled me most while I was researching the book. I had no idea about this before. According to a great American anthropologist called C. Loring Brace, he started studying human jaws. He got very interested in the structure of our teeth. And he found that if you looked at skeletal remains, there was a big change around 250 years ago. We used to have what orthodontists would call an edge-to-edge bite. So the top layer of our teeth would clash against the bottom layer, which is still what you see in primates or apes. But then 250 years ago, quite suddenly, the human jaw changes and you have an overbite, which means that the top layer of teeth fit over the bottom like a lid on a box. And C. Loring Brace, you couldn't think of any explanation based on what was eaten at that time. There was no dramatic alteration in the ingredients of the diet that somebody that was rich in the West would be eating. But what did change was how we ate. And his thesis, which I find completely persuasive, is that it was the adoption of the knife and fork that changed our teeth, because we were for the first time chopping food into small morsels and then popping it into our mouth, rather than regularly clamping large pieces of food in our jaw. It actually changed the way that our teeth developed from infancy onwards. There's not a Darwinian thing, because the time frame is far too short, but it does nevertheless show how these things, knives and forks, which we think can be quite irrelevant almost, or just a matter of manners, can have this profound impact on the human body.
Yeah, very interesting. So what are some other utensils or technologies or gadgets that have been around for a very long time that have withstood the test of time?
I mean, one that has withstood the test of time is the mortar and pestle. I mean, that's grinding tools have been around for at least 10,000 years and have remained remarkably constant. I mean, the sort of craggy granite mortars and pestles that you can find in quite fancy cookware stores today would not have looked out of place in ancient Mesopotamia. And yet I find that a really interesting one, because the form has remained very constant, but the social and culinary connotations of the mortar and pestle are completely different now, because it's gone from being something that people, mostly women, were using just a back-breaking tool of labor for grinding enough subsistence to get you through the day. And there's this evidence, again, looking at skeletons, that many women of quite a young age had severe arthritis and strain on their hips from this repetitive action of grinding. You know, that word we use, the grindstone, we now just use it in a kind of symbolic sense, but it was literal. And now, I mean, I love my mortar and pestle. It's a fun thing. I get it out. I make some pesto. I make some Thai curry paste. I can use it. I cannot use it. The connotations have completely changed, even though the object is very similar.
Yeah, and nothing beats the wooden spoon?
Nothing beats the wooden spoon. I think if you ask, well, we're going to get onto this later with your listeners, but if you ask most cooks what their favorite implement is, I'm really struck by how often they say a wooden spoon. And I've never been into a kitchen that didn't have one. And it's a great example of an implement that, yes, it might be very humble and it might not seem clever and it doesn't have an on-off switch and flashing lights or a patent. But it does the job that it does so well as inspiring a kind of affection. And I think the best tools are not necessarily those that create culinary fireworks. They're those that we feel comfortable with. And the wooden spoon does a great job of that. It feels like a kind of old familiar friend as you pick it up again, ready to stir something in a pan.
Yeah, certainly we will talk with our listeners about their favorite or most important kitchen tool or utensil or technology as we go along. But often you will hear chefs on the cooking shows and such saying that their most important tool is a really good knife. Talk about the knife.
Well, the knife, almost every chef I've met, if you ask them what the most important tool is, they say the knife, and they say it in this really kind of, well, of course, the knife sort of way, as if what a stupid question. And I think really the knife to being a chef is as fundamental as scissors might be to a hairdresser. And I think we sometimes forget, because we sort of think cooking is all about the application of heat, that the first part of any meal is the chopping, and that predates the application of heat by millions of years. And the knife is a fascinating object because on the one hand, the technology of making knives is all about getting them sharper and sharper and sharper. And once we discovered steel, it was possible to make tools, knives in the kitchen, which were amazingly sharp. But then on the other hand, we've always had this terror of kitchen knives because they are just one step away from being a weapon. So there's a question in different food cultures about how do we manage the violence of knives. And in the East, whether it's Japan or China, the solution is to do all of the chopping in the kitchen out of sight so that no cutting is done at the table at all. And everything is in a form that you can just use chopsticks to pick it up and eat it with. Whereas in the West, I think we've managed the violence of the knife by creating this object, the table knife, which is almost a contradiction in terms because it's so blunt, it doesn't really do a very good job of chopping anything. Hence the fact that when you go to a steakhouse and you actually need to cut a steak, they bring you a steak knife instead.
Why do you say the focus of our kitchen lives has moved from fire to ice?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting one. I mean, the word focus itself derives from the Latin for fireplace. And the single thing that human beings once constructed their kitchens, their homes, and arguably their lives around was the fire. The open hearth was the single thing around which you huddled to keep warm, used it to heat water, you used it to cook with. But now the starting point for most kitchens, the single sort of designer item that people think, well, I know that this has to be there and then everything else can go around it, is the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And I think a bit like we're taking the fork for granted, the refrigerator is so fundamental to our lives that we can't really conceive what life would have been like without it. But it transformed not just the way that people cook, but certainly in the United States, the entire food supply would have been different before the refrigerator became a standard item in the early to mid-20th century. And things like fresh vegetables, fresh meat, orange juice, these only became year-round staples thanks to refrigerated cars and then refrigerators in the home. And I think it does have this kind of emotional pull as well. It does seem to be the heart of the kitchen. We don't have a constant fire burning because we're able to summon fire at will, whether it's using a gas cooktop or whether it's using an electric oven. But the thing that is constantly on is the refrigerator. And I sense that when we can't quite think what to do, we kind of open the door of the refrigerator and stare long and hard into it as if it's going to give us the answer to life's great questions.
Mm-hmm. So what forces drive the invention of new kitchen technologies?
I mean, it's partly need, but it always goes beyond that. I mean, I think one of the things about kitchen technologies, like other technologies, is that they come in clusters. So during the period when roasting large haunches of meat was the main way that rich people were eating, there was a host of other implements that went alongside spit roasting. So there were kind of andirons and brandirons, and there were all these complicated turnspit devices, some of them clockwork, some of them water-powered, for turning the roast on the spit. And then once spit roasting became more or less obsolete, all of the other tools died out as well. You can see the same thing happening with the microwave gets invented, and then suddenly we all need to have microwavable dishes and microwavable cling film. So these things kind of come in fits and starts, and it's unpredictable. Sometimes the tools which were invented in a great flurry of intelligence and science are no improvement on what went before. We've all got useless gadgets in our kitchens, haven't we? I mean, we've all got probably one of those drawers which you can't quite open because it's so stuffed with digital things that we thought were going to change our lives and actually just made it slightly more complicated and difficult.
Yeah, do you want a salad shooter?
A what?
A salad shooter is one of those gadgets. It's an automatic. It'll chop up cucumbers and carrots and that sort of thing.
Ah,
it's electric.
Electric herb choppers, I think of as being the most useless device. It's probably similar to that. Yeah.
Right. But you talk about the electric rice cooker. That's not a useless kitchen gadget?
It all depends how you cook. I mean, if you talk to Koreans or Japanese cooks, if you're a cook that is eating sticky, short-grained rice every single day as part of the evening meal, then the electric rice cooker is a completely wonderful, life-changing object. I mean, it was, we talk about the kind of electronics revolution of post-war Japan, and we sort of think of Sony Walkmans and TVs and video players. But we forget that there was also, it went on in the kitchen as well. And in Korean families where previously it would have taken several hours to wash the rice, cook it in an earthenware dish, watch it like a hawk so that it didn't catch and burn, you could now do this at a flick of a switch. So I personally had an electric rice cooker for a while and then gave up on it because I find I don't make rice more than about two or three times a week and just an ordinary pot is fine for me. But it all depends on how you cook.
Yeah.
And there's a great book, a short academic monograph called Where There Are Asians, There Are Rice Cookers. And it has this real emotional pull. I mean, you'll find that in the Korean diaspora, when people travel and go abroad, they bring the rice cooker with them because it's basic. That's how you make a meal.
We're talking with Bea Wilson. She is author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. And we welcome your questions for her about the kitchens of the past and, for that matter, the kitchens of the future, too. And we welcome your favorite kitchen tool or utensil or technology. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you are with us tomorrow at this time. I'm going to be off. John Munson will be here, and he will talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week. It's the Week in Review tomorrow between 8 and 9. Right now, we're talking about how we cook things and why we cook them that way and how we eat things and how that has changed and how kitchen technologies have a whole lot to do with this. We are talking with the author of Consider the Fork. And we have many callers, so let's go to Bill in Milwaukee next. Hello, Bill.
Well, good morning. Good morning, Joy and B. I have a new version of a fork. A couple of years ago, I decided it would be good for my brain to learn to use chopsticks to eat, and so I've carried some home with me, and I use them a lot around the kitchen. I use them, like it a lot, because they're wooden and natural, and they don't scrape metal surfaces, and they're handy for lots of things around the kitchen.
Like what?
Well, just this morning, I picked broken eggshells out of an over-easy egg yolk before it was cooking in the skillet with my chopsticks. It was very handy to just kind of reach in there and grab them, pull them out. I use them for scraping coffee grounds out of the bean grinder in the morning. It doesn't scrape the little metal cup in the bean grinder. I use them to turn things in the skillet. When I'm frying sliced leftover baked potatoes, I use chopsticks to turn the potatoes over. They're
neat.
Surprisingly handy to have around.
Are you eating with them every day?
Not every day, but I do often.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, what do you think of that, Bea?
I think it's a great idea. And I guess the thing that Bill must have is the skill to use it. Because, I mean, the missing ingredient in so many tools is actually the dexterity of knowing what to do with them. But some of those ideas are great. I'm going to use the one of the coffee grinder. I'm always getting annoyed when the coffee beans get stuck just as they're going through the burr. Yeah, that's great. Actually, that goes back to a kind of older use of the fork. The amazing thing about forks is although they've only been around as eating tools for a very short time, as cooking tools, they're really ancient. I mean, we've always wanted just what Bill has described. I mean, a kind of all-purpose prong that can be used for kind of picking things up or turning things over on the fire. So that thing of using a chopstick for the skillet, great.
Yeah, I do have a difficult time. Well, I've used them from time to time eating, but they're kind of hard to hold. I'm wondering if Asian cultures do not use the fork still. The chopsticks are still the primary eating utensil?
They are still the primary eating utensil. I mean, it's said that the definition of Japanese food is that it has to be eaten with a chopstick. But I think with the growing globalization of diet across the world and the fact that there is far more westernized cuisine in Asia, forks are now not unheard of. But I think, I mean, the chopstick is still absolutely fundamental. And it works so well if you know how to use them. It's only that thing that, I mean, I think a lot of Westerners feel very diffident around chopsticks because if you don't have the skill, then they're just completely useless and you just feel so clumsy, don't you? It's a bit like learning how to use a knife and fork again as a child. And there's that thing that you can, I mean, in China, when children are being taught how to use chopsticks, they're sometimes joined together with a rubber band to make it easier. But I think that thing of just learning how to use chopsticks as an extension of your hand, it doesn't come naturally unless you've been doing it for many years.
Let me just speculate on something. When I'm eating with chopsticks, I, you know, like picking up rice or anything, it can be a little bit difficult for me because I'm not used to it. But I'm also eating I'm eating smaller bites. Mm. And if I have a big honking spoon, I can eat a whole lot more. And I'm wondering if you've looked into our eating utensils and our weight.
That's a really interesting question. I have read some academic papers suggesting, not on chopsticks, but suggesting that simply serving food in smaller portions from soup from a smaller bowl, people will consume less, which makes sense, doesn't it? Because you still feel you've eaten a full bowl of soup, even if actually it might be half the quantity of a full bowl of soup that's twice the size. So I'm sure psychologically there is something, and I mean anything that gets you to slow down and eat more mindfully, that has to help, doesn't it, to get you to consume less.
And let's take another call. Chris in La Crosse is with us next. Hello, Chris.
Yes, hi. No cook kitchen would be worth anything if you didn't have a good ricer.
I'm sorry, a good what? Ricer?
A ricer, that's right.
What's a ricer?
Kind of like a garlic press, only larger. And you put your potatoes or yams or steamed cauliflower or whatever through it. And it makes absolute perfect consistency for your mashed potatoes, say like on Thanksgiving, and your yams and all that.
Oh,
or
it's,
if you want an alternative.
So it mashes it up.
Well, it presses it through. I mean, kind of picture a metal, like maybe a half cup size thimble, for the lack of a better description, that has the holes on the bottom like a garlic press, and then it has the plunger on top, and you squeeze everything through the holes, and what you end up with is a perfect consistency for mashed potatoes, yams, or if you want an alternative to mashed potatoes, you could have a mashed cauliflower, like you steam cauliflower, or you steam the cauliflower and the broccoli heads together and then mash them together, and it makes a perfect, I mean, absolute perfect side dish.
Well, thank you very much for that. I've never heard of a ricer that does that. I'm not the greatest chef in the world either, but B. Wilson, he says no kitchen is complete without a good ricer.
I agree. I'm so happy you said that. It's currently my favorite utensil, and I came to it quite late. Partly, my mother taught me to mash potatoes just using one of those old-fashioned handheld mashers, and my mashed potatoes were always slightly lumpy. And since I've started using a ricer, just as the caller describes, it extrudes the potatoes through these metal discs, and it's incredibly easy and satisfying and quick to use. And then you find that you have wonderful, smooth, ethereal, lump-free mash. So, yeah, get one for Thanksgiving.
All right.
It really does make better mashed potato. And it's just simple. It's not, you kind of look and think, oh, it would take so long to spoon the potatoes in and squeeze them. But it's really no more time and infinitely better results.
Wonderful. I'm going to have to check into that. Of all things, when he mentioned making mashed cauliflower, I did make that the other day because I had a big cauliflower, and someone suggested that it was a good substitute or a lower carb substitute for mashed potatoes. And the recipe that I was following called for putting an immersion blender into the pot. I so happen to have one of those, but I haven't used it in like 10 years, but I did use it for that. And when I was describing this to some friends, they were like, what's the immersion blender? I mean, I guess there are so many different gadgets that we can't keep track of them
all. I use my immersion blender every single day. I'm completely addicted to it. But the one thing I would never use it for would be mashed potato, because the cellular starch structure of potatoes is such that it's horrible when you over mash them and then they go all gummy.
Oh.
I don't know. It's one of the few things that you can't do in a Cuisinart or a blender, whether it's an immersion blender or the other old-fashioned kind with a goblet. So for that, the potato ricer is fantastic because it just eliminates all lumps without overworking the potato.
Neat.
So, yeah, really, get one. And they don't cost that much either.
Sounds good. We are talking with Bea Wilson. She is the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. And we're welcoming your questions for her, and we're welcoming your calls on what is the most important kitchen utensil or technology to you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And Kenny in Wisconsin Dells is with us next. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, say back in the 60s, I grew up and my mother was quite an avid cook, and she always believed in buying a utensil that could be used for more than one purpose. And the wooden spoon was very handy for her, not only for cooking, but as a disciplinarian tool. And I was just wondering how your guests thought about that. And what I'll do is I'll just take the comment offline, if you would. Thank you.
Did you get into using the spoon as a paddling tool?
Yeah, I couldn't endorse the use of any kitchen utensils as weapons, but I'm sure all of them in various households have been used as such over the years, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, even I have a bit in my book about the spork, which I think many people regard as a kind of joke object, but there was a case of somebody attacking somebody else using a fast food plastic spork, and you'd kind of think it wouldn't have the power to do that. But, yeah, I think anything, kitchen objects are just the things we have to hand at the point we get angry, aren't they? So I've never attacked anyone with any of my kitchen gadgets, nor do I wish to do so. But I'm sure, yes, they have all been used as weapons, I'm sure.
Well, looking back at all of these kitchen technologies through history, Bea Wilson, and what we have right now, can you foresee what might be in the kitchen of the future?
I think one of the things in the kitchen of the future is that there ought to be, and almost certainly will be, tools which make a better, more efficient use of energy. So things like, actually I only became a convert to this since I finished writing the book, but the pressure cooker, which is used throughout Latin America in kitchens where people have maybe only got gas canisters to cook with and they have to really husband the gas. And it just being able to cook something in a fraction of the time using far less fuel is going to be more important in a kind of carbon-scarce world. But I often get asked to predict what the kitchen of the future is going to look like. And my real prediction is that the kitchen of the future is going to look very much like the kitchen of the present, in that I don't think we are any point soon going to move beyond using knives to chop, using spoons to stir with, using pots and pans, because these things do the job that they do very well. And part of what my book was trying to do was trying to say these things that we take for granted actually have a huge history behind them. It took massive invention to get to the point of somebody thinking of first boiling something in a pot. You know, pots themselves were a huge innovation, admittedly 10,000 years ago, but still.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to improve on. You could make a better pot, and you could sort of think of various different metals that you could sandwich together in a clever way to kind of maximize heat conduction and minimize hot spots. But I can't quite see that we're going to do a kind of cooking that dispenses with pots altogether. So broadly speaking, I think it's going to be the same, but I'm sure some of the things that we're attached to now will seem strange and obsolete in the future. I can't quite see these high-tech modernist tools like the sous vide machine and the packagette and the anti-griddle. I can't see those being staple tools for many cooks, say, 100 years from now. But I might be completely wrong. I mean, the thing with all predictions is you can be rendered foolish by events.
Let's take some more calls. Bruce in Cumberland wants to talk about pots and pans, I believe. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. I recently started cooking paella. We had some couples over for dinner, and I was just amazed with even something. It's a traditional Spanish dish with rice, and it's completely different than Asian rice. But the technology of the different types of pans they still have available, either the carbon steel, the stainless steel, the Teflon coated, and all the different cookers. And here's a traditional dish that they're still working on new technologies to do it.
And do you have a special pan to make the paella too, Bruce?
Yeah, there's actually websites you can go to, and they have paella pans. It's this one's the one I have is 19 inches round, and it's a little big for my cooktops, but it works. And it's special pans, and they actually have special propane cookers you can buy and put on your deck just for the paella pan.
Yeah, B. Wilson?
Paella pans are a great example of how a dish is linked to a specific utensil. And there's a kind of science behind them, isn't there? Because there's a kind of, as the sizes go up, the ratio of the rice to the liquid has to remain exactly right. It's also an interesting example. We often have these kind of personal feelings about utensils. And in Spain, the paella pan, traditionally, was only ever meant to be used by men, and it was only ever meant to be used outdoors. It was cooked on an open fire.
Really?
But sometimes, and they would be huge, some of these things. But sometimes women in Spain would want to make a kind of similar dish of short-grained rice cooked with kind of stock and lots of other ingredients getting absorbed with all of the same flavors as paella, but they wouldn't call it paella because they just knew that paella was something that men made and was cooked outside. So they might say, this is chicken and rice, because somehow it couldn't be paella unless it was being made by men and outdoors. But yeah, I would love to have a paella pan, but I make very inauthentic paellas, kind of just using a kind of all-purpose big stainless steel skillet.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Bruce. So what about the tools we use to measure things? I understand from your book that we use spoons and measuring cups while the rest of the world measures by weight. Why are we so different?
It's a really interesting example of the way in which the States is completely different from the rest of the world. The great food writer Ray Sokolov, who used to be the food critic for the Wall Street Journal, once wrote that is one of the sort of most important and least recognized aspects of being American, that Americans measure things with cups, whereas the rest of the world weighs things on scales. And I think it's, as with all these things, it's a combination of the kind of rationale and logic behind it, but there's also just habit and custom and what you feel familiar with. So there's some speculation that it's part of the pioneer lifestyle. If you're on a wagon, it's easy to bring some cups along, but you don't want to be weighing yourself down with a huge set of scales and weights. But I think it also goes back to the fact that the best-selling cookbook in America, at the point that people were first buying cookbooks in great quantities, was the Fanny Farmer cookbook. Mm. And she just believed that the most scientific approach to cooking was to take measuring cups and to measure them level. And she got a case knife and would kind of sweep off the edge of the flour. And because she learned to cook using cups and felt completely safe and comfortable with them, the thousands of people who bought her book learned to cook the same way. And then it became a completely entrenched part of what it meant to be a cook in America. And although in my book I say it makes no sense really measuring things with cups, because if you look at a cup full of flour, it can vary in weight by as much as 4 to 6 ounces. So that could make the difference between the cake working and the cake not working. But on the other hand, all of the many cooks who have been using cups to make their cakes over the years will say, well, my cakes work just fine. And in addition, I think that what cups do a very good job of is they make you feel kind of safe and at home in your kitchen. And maybe Americans have more of a sense of that than Europeans. I don't know. I mean, I'm very attached to my digital scales.
Yeah, interesting. I can't imagine cooking or baking with scales, but that's because I've never done it before.
It probably just seems weird, doesn't it? It just seems a little bit. And I think from American perspective, the thing of measuring on scales, it seems slightly like a laboratory, doesn't it? Or slightly inhuman in some way.
But at least I have an excuse for why that cake doesn't work out every time.
Yeah, you do.
Bea Wilson is with us. She is the author of Consider the Fork, a history of how we cook and eat, talking about kitchen technologies, kitchen gadgets, and how they have evolved and how they affect the way we eat, talking about how we cook things and how that matters just as much, if not more, than what we cook. And we're welcoming your questions for her. We're welcoming your favorite kitchen utensil. What's the most important kitchen utensil to you today? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. On the other hand, maybe you have a kitchen gadget that no longer is useful to you today. That's just sitting in a cupboard somewhere. Let us know about that, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you coming up. We will hear after 9 o'clock that last week's election most likely settled the fate of the Affordable Care Act, and Kathleen and her guest will talk about how provisions of the act will now be implemented. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking about our food and how we cook and how we eat with the author of Consider the Fork, Bea Wilson. Bea Wilson is a food writer, historian, author of a weekly food column for the Sunday Telegraph's Stella magazine. And our next caller for her is Sue in Appleton. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I just wanted to say the one kitchen gadget, and I've had a lot over the years, that a lot of them have fallen by the wayside, but the one I purchased probably 5 years ago that I can't live without is the Magic Bullet.
What do you do with it, Sue?
Well, every morning we grind our coffee beans with it, and you don't need chopsticks to clean it. That's the greatest thing. It is so easy to clean. We always tried the coffee bean grinders before, and they were difficult to clean and kind of a pain, and then we would just go back to buying our coffee beans already ground, which, of course, it doesn't taste as good then. And with the Magic Bullet, you can grind them every morning. The parts are very easy to clean, and it's ready for the next morning. And the other thing is you don't have then multiple things sitting on the counter, because the other thing we use it for every day is our smoothies.
And it doesn't taste like coffee then either?
No, because there's two different blades. There's two different bases to it. So we just keep the one we use for coffee beans is kind of exclusively for coffee beans. And then the other ones we can use for smoothies, because it comes with a bunch of different cups.
Well, I will tell you, Sue, that I also have a Magic Bullet, and I use it every day for a smoothie, every single
day. There you
go. Yeah. So,
try it for your coffee beans. You'll be pleasantly surprised how well it works for that.
Yeah, now I've got a Keurig, so I don't do my own grinding usually. But
I
know what you mean. I mean, I'm wondering how I kind of laughed. Actually, it was my husband who suggested, hey, let's get one of these things. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, I never get something that I would think from an infomercial. But we use it every day, so I suppose that's all that matters, Bea Wilson?
I've never come across the Magic Bullet. I want one now.
Yeah, it's a little blender, tiny blender. It can do other things, right, too. It can make the soups.
And there's a tiny blender that you use to make smoothies. I've never thought that you could have a machine that would both be so multifunctional. You could use it for coffee and smoothies.
Yeah, it is amazing. I know what Sue is talking about. Is there, you know, some of that stuff in the infomercials, we do laugh at, like, you know, there's a guy, at least here, does a commercial. Well, he did do a commercial called the Slap Chop, and I think that might be the herb. You know, it's one of those choppers, and it was just a goofy thing. And I think you thought that herb chopper was kind of useless. I was laughing about the salad shooter as well, not being used very much. Was there a huge failure of a kitchen technology or gadget that you know, that was of historical significance?
I think there's one, which is, there was this strange phenomenon, the egg beater boom that happened in the United States in the 1860s, 1870s, where there were over 600 different patents issued for egg beaters, the most famous of which was the Dover, which some people do still use, which is that hand-operated one, which has got the two paddles going round as opposed to just one. But I find it really annoying because you've got to use two hands to operate it, and then the mixing bowl kind of skids around, and then you find you have mixture all over the floor. But the strange thing, of these 600 egg beaters that were invented, not one of them, so far as I could tell, was an improvement on the old-fashioned French balloon whip or balloon whisk, which is still used by chefs in high-end kitchens today. And that balloon whisk had been invented way back, probably in the 16th century. So that's a really good example of, there was just a dead end where suddenly, I mean, obviously people were making money out of these things, but the benefit to the consumer was not obvious at all. And the same is probably true of loads of these infomercial kind of herb choppers or whatever they might be, kitchen rotary things. And yet they do such a great job of selling them, don't they? I mean, I sometimes get mesmerized going around a department store and you'll see some guy and he's trying to tell you that if you spend kind of £400 or dollars on this thing, that it's actually going to save you money in the long run. That's the thing. They always sort of tell you, actually, it's going to be so economical. How can you not buy one? And it's hugely tempting because I think the kitchen is one of the spheres of our lives in which we kind of dream dreams and imagine different lives for ourselves. And buying new gadgets feeds into that. But it's very unusual that you find something that really does improve your life.
So have the new kitchen technologies led to the decline in cooking skills?
No, I would argue not. I mean, there is the kind of cliche that, you know, what happens now is that we kind of sit watching TV shows on the food networks while we're actually just kind of eating a microwavable dinner or some fast food. But I think in many ways, the kind of best of the new kitchen technologies have kept old cuisines alive. If you look at things like food processors, they enable people to, in the Middle East, to kind of make really laborious things like kibbeh, which once would have taken women hours of pounding to do, and you can now just do it at flick of a switch. I wouldn't blame the kitchen technologies per se for the death of the cooking skills. I think our kitchens are now better equipped than they've ever been at any point in history. So there's every reason that we should be able to cook. I think there are many other factors going on, ranging from the way in which the food supply has changed to different patterns of work, to just the death of skills from one generation to another. We don't have the same thing of children necessarily learning to cook things from scratch from their mothers. Partly because, I mean, we can't lament the fact that women are not chained to the kitchen anymore. That's good in loads of ways. And one of the things that I see as being one of the greatest changes was the invention of the gas oven around the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, because it just freed up so much of women's time, which previously had been devoted to getting a fire going and keeping it going. And then suddenly there were hours of the day free for doing other things. I think that's wonderful. It's just, yeah, we don't want to lose cooking skills, but I can't really blame the tools. I think there are vast social changes going on which more explain the lack of cooking.
Our next caller is Aaron in Madison. Hi, Aaron.
Yeah, hey.
Hi.
Hi. Do I start talking?
Yeah. What do you have in mind? What's going on?
Oh, okay. Something I came across on the internet, and it's kind of like one of those really simple innovations that, you know, why didn't you think of that? Basically, it's a boiling pot, but they put kind of like screwed grooves around the edges. And what that does is that it, like, when the bubbles bubble up the side, it goes kind of in a current around it. So it automatically stirs once you boil it. So I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool, and I think that should come standard. But
I'm trying to picture this. So what's actually – something is in the pot that's going to move once it starts boiling, and it will automatically stir whatever's in the pot.
No. Nothing's moving. Just the walls of the pot are they have kind of like a screw groove in it. So it automatically, like, as the water travels up, it actually, like, gets pushed around.
Okay, I'm sorry, I just misunderstood. All right. Well, interesting. An automatic pots that stirs itself, B. Wilson. Have you ever heard of that?
Stirring pot. No, I've never come across one of those. That sounds extraordinary if it works. I mean, I quite enjoy the process of stirring a pot, but yeah, there are occasions where you certainly would like to walk off and do something else.
Thanks. Wow. Thanks very much, Aaron. Jennifer in La Crosse emails, as a part of my Sunday school lesson this past weekend, I had my fourth graders make a cake. The recipe called for a can of diced pineapple, for which I had them use a traditional handheld manual can opener. They were all so surprised and couldn't understand why we had to use something so old-fashioned. They wanted to use their electric ones. Interesting. I guess I think about, I use a regular, I had an electric can opener for a while, and I thought I didn't like it. I
don't like electric can openers either, but maybe I haven't come across the right one. I mean, sometimes the early electric versions of things weren't very good, and then you kind of try it and get put off, and maybe the ones around now are better. But yeah, I'm perfectly happy with my hand crank one.
Yeah.
And often we assume that electric is better and more efficient. One of the things I found that most startled me was the discovery that actually there was an amazing British female inventor called Mrs. Marshall in the late 19th century who invented a hand cranking ice cream maker that could do it in 5 minutes.
Oh.
Which is much, much faster than any of the electric machines on sale today. And she did it by, the machine that she invented was a little bit like the Nancy Johnson invented kind of bucket designed ice cream cranker that lots of people still have, I think, in the States and bring out for fun in the summer, and the kids have a go, and it sort of, that takes about 20 minutes, half an hour. But the Mrs. Marshall one is just much wider and shallower, and I've seen one work. It really does do the job in just 5 minutes, and yet nobody's marketing this today.
I was going to say, I want one of those, but
I want one too. Yeah.
Nora in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Nora.
Hi, I want one of those too.
Yeah. Let's start something here.
My husband and I, well, my family, we eat a lot of yogurt, and we got very tired of all of the containers and the expense of organic yogurt. So we started making our own yogurt in our slow cooker crock pot. And I wondered if you've ever heard of that.
So you have a crock pot that you make yogurt in, huh?
Yeah, we heat it. You have to have a thermometer. My kids tried to make it, they tried to wire it so that it was electronic with a timer and everything, but it turns out easier to just have a thermometer. You bring the milk up to temperature in the crock pot. It doesn't burn because it's, you know, a slow cooker. I do this on Saturday when I'm doing other cooking or other things around the house. Then when it gets to temperature, you know, that achieves whatever, I'm not sure exactly the science of it, but it has to reach a certain temperature to kill something off. And then you let it drop back down to the next level of temperature. You turn it on lower, or actually turn it off. Add in your starter, maybe add in a little powder milk,
yeah.
And then you just take the crock and you stick it in the oven with some towels and no temperature, but just in the oven so that it kind of slowly gets cool and it thickens up. And by the next day, or, you know, maybe 10 hours later, you have a gallon of organic yogurt for, you know, $5.
Wow, that sounds doable, I guess. Nora, no, I haven't heard of that. Bea Wilson, have you?
I haven't. I think it sounds wonderful. I think it's a really clever example of how if you kind of approach the tools you've already got in your kitchen with a bit of ingenuity, you can get more work out of them. I have heard of people using slow cookers and hacking them in some way, again, using thermometers to turn them into sous vide machines. But I haven't heard of people using them for yogurt. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you, Nora. I remember way back in the, gosh, I think it was in the 70s that we had in the home I grew up in a yogurt maker, little cups, the whole thing, and it was okay.
They were quite fashionable for a while, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Now, no, but,
and then people somehow went back to buying yogurt. But,
yeah.
But as you say, if you're consuming it in great quantities, then it would be definitely worth making.
Making your own, yeah. Jerry in Argyle is with us now. Hi, Jerry. We're getting close to the top of the hour. Did you have some favorite gadgets?
Yes. My all-time favorite, I guess, has to be the cast iron skillet.
Yeah, why do you like that so much?
Well, people have been trying to replace it with the non-stick of cast iron with Teflon and all these different chemical things to keep the pan from being sticky. And a little bit of oil, and if it ever gets damaged, you can always renew that seasoning on the pan, and they'll last several lifetimes.
Yeah, I know you have another one, Jerry, but let me get a quick comment from Bea on the cast iron skillet.
I'm so with you there. I love my cast iron skillet. And as you say, it gets better over time, unlike nonstick pans, which get worse.
Yeah, he also wanted to talk about his bread maker, but unfortunately we have less than a minute to go. Do you have any qualms about the electric bread maker?
I have an electric bread maker myself, and I think, you know, they don't make bread as good as the finest artisanal baker is going to make, but it's a lot better than the bread you buy in the supermarket.
That's true. Yeah. Well, what's your takeaway from Consider the Fork? What would you like our listeners to remember?
Tools matter, and we feel very strongly about them, as your listeners have shown. I mean, I think we sometimes just think that these objects are inanimate and we don't have strong feelings about them, and actually people get quite passionate about different pots and pans. They're part of our life.
And this was really a fascinating hour. Never thought considering the fork would be so fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Bea Wilson, author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster, Amanda Magnus, and Bill Martins for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.